നമോതസ ഭഗവതോ അർഹതോ സമ്മാ സംബുദ്ധസ്സ നമോതസ ഭഗവതോ അർഹതോ സമ്മാ സംബുദ്ധസ്സ നമോതസ ഭഗവതോ അർഹതോ സമ്മാ സംബുദ്ധസ്സ ഭൂതാം ധമ്മാം സംഗ്രഹം സാം
Great spirit of speech education I was given as a youth. The formula, tell them what you're going to tell them, tell them, tell them what you told them. Which I was told when I was quite young, and it turns out it's quite interesting. The Buddha uses that formula in almost all of his talks. I'm like, huh, look at that. He had a good teacher when he was young. So I'm going to reflect a little bit on the things we've chanted this evening. In particular, the four requisites. It's a very practical place that we can reflect. And in order to really establish that person, to go through some of the where it occurs and in the context of which that teaching is extracted from. So it's in multiple places, but I think one of the most important places that this is in the second sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's the Sambhasava Sutta. It's called All the Taints in English. And in this sutta, the Buddha gives seven ways to restrain the asavas. So as a matter of context still, what are the asavas? The asavas are the effluence. They're these propensity, this underlying tendency that objects can kind of sit and ride upon. This is the kind of underlying movement or motivation of the mind that we build our stories upon. And so that the goal is to really kind of settle the mind so we can see these underlying motivations. And so these seven different techniques that the Buddha uses, puts forth. And the first one, the most important one, is sensual indulgence. The second one would be becoming, self-making. And then third would be ignorance. And that's partially why I wanted to also recite the Anattalakkhana Sutta, because there's a little bit of a tie-in there with how we use things to create a sense of self. So I think you could easily have a talk on each one of the elements of the Sambhasava Sutta, but the seven main ways that one Buddha structures to restrain and subdue the asavas are seeing, restraint, using, enduring, removing, avoiding, and cultivating. I'll try to go through those briefly. The first one, seeing, is very simply, again, in very brief, it's seeing things instead of around self, around I am future, the past, this is me, this is mine, seeing things around the Four Noble Truths. The restraint of sense spaces is around, restraint is around the restraint of the sense spaces, not overindulging in looking, tasting, and seeing, because these then lead to further indulgences. The third is using, which is what the four requisites provides the detail on. So this is where we'll be talking about the four requisites. Avoiding is that you're supposed to avoid dangerous places, avoiding unskillful people. Enduring is that you're just going to sometimes have bad situations, pains, and you just cold heat, and you just have to endure them. Removing is like when all else fails, it's just not acceptable to have, let's say, anger and unskillful mind states, so you have to take, you know, I think he uses the terminology gritting your teeth and clamping down, crushing mind with mind, and you have to remove unwholesome, skillful mental states. And then the final one is developing, and that is the seven factors of awakening. That's a little more of a broader picture on one's cultivation of the path. So let's just, you know, the main focus of this is these proper use of requisites. Now, this is in a context of monastic, but I found this even when I was a lay person, this can be very, very useful for how one interacts with the world and can help often solve motivational issues in one's life as a lay person. So it's a very broad teaching actually in that regard. Again, though, these are designed to restrain sensual indulgence, ideas of becoming and self, self-making, and just straight ignorance. So, taking up the first one of the four reflections, we have the wisely reflecting, I use the robe. And these all seem very straightforward, but if they were so straightforward, it would be, we'd all be living under the archetypical ideal that is put forth by you know, the great monastics. But it clearly is that even as monastics, many can't do that. And as lay people, we're not doing that. We're doing something else. We're doing something more. And why is it that we're doing that? It's either sensual indulgence, some idea of fabricating a sense of self, or ignorance to the nature of things, that they're suffering, not permanent. So, you know, in the monastic rules, we have a whole slew of rules around how we properly treat our robes. And typically, in the traditional fashion, we would collect scraps of cloth and sew the robes with scraps. It's, back in the day of the Buddha's time, fabric was extremely rare and hard to come by, and this was the standard by which monastics began. But even in the later parts of the dispensation, the robes and cloth became more common, and the Buddha allowed further allowances to have like full robe cloth given. He offers to Mahakasapa, like, hey, you've been wearing these rag robes for years, you're getting older, why don't you take on some better robes? And he shows that the example can be maintained, and says that he'll maintain it for the sake of future generations. But it's very easy to see how people use their clothing and or accoutrement, accessories, to create a form of self-identity. You know, the whole fashion business, the idea of wearing a certain brand, trademark, or logo, which will then convey some kind of, I'm like this other person, or I'm successful. I think one of the craziest examples I ever saw was when, back in my day as an electrician, this young guy came in, and him and his friends had gotten a tattoo machine. Somebody bought one or something, and he had tattooed a corporate logo from a clothing manufacturer on his leg. And you're like, this young guy doesn't realize how fast these things are. These things flicker through time. And he's stuck with it to this day, I imagine. But this is what we do when we want to create some form of self-identity. But there's also other ways that we can utilize, and this goes a little outside of the cloth requisite, but our things. Is that they can also be used in a certain way, territorially. We can use them. Like in the monastic form, we really much pretty much have to have the example that the Buddha gives as being like a bird, where you leave no trace, and you should be able to go anywhere at any moment. And unlike an animal that leaves footprints, a bird leaves no trace. And so typically in the Thai tradition, you really don't have any space that's your space. If you have anything, you would keep it right next to your seat or on your seat. The idea of having a kuti is a very transient thing. We have rules around like kicking somebody out of a kuti, but you should be willing to give up your kuti, and it's not really your kuti. The abbots traditionally have been able to just drop in and inspect them, or have some people are on tour, so you need to maintain that And there's a whole slew of rules around maintaining it because it's not really your property. It's the property of the Sangha. So one really should tell you to take on as a monastic this idea that I really don't have anything other than these four requisites. And I should maintain them in a very proper way and take care of them. In particular around the cloth, we have rules that if, let's say, my robe were to rip, and there's certain allowances I won't get into, like around the border, if I don't repair that robe before the next dawn, it would be basically not a proper robe anymore, and I would have to relinquish that robe and confess it as not properly maintained requisite cloth. So the Buddha sets forth rules that, you know, encourage us to minimize our footprint, take care of our robes, and along the lines of the space is to use this reflection as to what is private space and public space. You don't really have, you know, I guess in the world, like the supreme examples, this guy's got a fancy car and he takes up two parking spots. Like, hey, my car's special, I'm going to take up two parking spots. You shouldn't just be leaving your stuff in a monastic environment, laying around. It just doesn't, it's not conducive to a harmony of the community. And for lay people, this is something you can also, like, in your own personal lives, in your family life, recognizing your own personal space or kids' personal space or adults' personal space, and where might I be intruding on their space or my neighbor's space? Am I, you know, because there is this inclination of people, and that's going back to the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, using, you know, in that sutta, it's often taken on, and we often take Anatta Lakkhana as being this really kind of metaphysical thing about the self as a body and the senses. But if you look at the second part of that, it's all about this internal and external, whether far or near. And what that's really pointing to is the fact that self-identity extends far outside of our own being. It extends all the way to view. It extends to, like, political affiliations or cultural affiliations or social affiliations. And we wrap then a self-identity around it. And these requisites, they're kind of an anchor to say, I need to pull back. And this is the best, if I really want to cultivate peace in my mind, this is the bare minimum. These four things, which just can sustain the body and provide the bare necessity of security to the body and the mind, so that I can cultivate those mind states that will lead to the dispassion of liberation. And if you're extending outside that, you're not going to get the subtlety of the mind states necessary to still the mind to see liberation. So these are very practical advice that really is quite instrumental in limiting the movement of the mind. In the fabrication of thoughts in particular, because we're often wrapping stories around to justify, this is my space, I want to do it for this reason, I want to have this, I need to give that, I need to receive that. These are all stories that we create in order to perpetuate our self-identity. And very simply as well, like just having the simple robes, it's quite hard, obviously, up here in the Great White North to get away with it. But, you know, we at Abhaya Gira, we still practice some monastics who practice what we call the rectangles practice, which is only having things that are the simple robes. And we have certain other korwat requirements for, like, bathing cloths and onksas, so that still provides very limited kind of protection during the... We get down to freezing in the winter in Northern California, and it can be quite difficult, but it's adequate. And it really puts you in face with the fabrication of, like, what is really cold. You know, if you really imbibe in the present sensations of the body, there is no sensation that is cold. There's, like, tension, tingling, throbbing, pulsing, heat, cold that are like, they're below the words, and they're so ephemeral and they change so much that as long as you don't like solidify them into something and make them an object, it actually has actual physical effects by not doing that. You keep your circulation flowing, you don't clench in on your muscles, and it allows the energy to flow, breathe through it, and you simply just don't get as cold. And you might not even ever even fabricate the idea, I'm cold. It's just like, oh really? It's just a transient period of time of a little inconvenience. So by utilizing this as a physical standard, it really gets you to experience this stuff and not just, you know, constantly avoid the situation by bundling up with long underwear, sweaters, hats, and all this other stuff, and which is, you know, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there. I've used this example of a, I think it's probably, to me, one of the most paramount statements in all of the canon, and I've used this example before. In the lesser discourse, or lesser questions and answers with Bhikkhuni Dhammadina, she makes this statement that I find to be, it's like the engine of samsara. She says, this isn't the critical part, she says, pleasant feelings are pleasant when they're pleasant and unpleasant when they cease, and unpleasant feelings are unpleasant when they're present and pleasant when they cease. And that's kind of universal. But she says, and this is the critical part, neutral sensations, when they're rightly seen or wrongly seen, are seen as painful, and neutral sensations, when they're correctly seen, are seen as pleasant. So here's a point in which we actually have the ability to discern and wisely recognize that states of neutrality are actually not suffering. But what people do in the world, and people who are not rightly seeing or doing, is they see that as unpleasant, and then they're seeking something to fill that space. And so this is the engine that drives people to seek pleasant sensations or self-creation. Because often in that seemingly empty space of neutrality, there is like, well, I'm not here. I got to think of something. I got some idea. That's got to, you know, you don't do this in a proactive way. Like, it just becomes the pattern of the mind, is to not be comfortable with a mind that's not actively thinking. And so your mind kicks up a thought, and then you chase that thought, and you're like, oh yeah, I'm right about this, he's wrong about that, she's right about this, if only they would do it this way, and then we create a sense of self, and we delight in this, just because we weren't comfortable with that few moments of neutrality. If you just stay with that neutrality, there's no suffering. And the majority of our time is without suffering, but we just won't wait around to recognize that. And when you see that, and there's that neutrality, and there's that non-movement of the mind, that non-movement of the mind is the higher bliss of a still chitta, the still mind that exceeds the sensual pleasure, because it's actually suffering. That mind is constantly moving and bouncing. There's no place where it ever can find any happiness, and that's the suffering. There's no anchor. There's no. Everything's constantly moving. Where's it going to be next? I have no idea. Well, if you just stay with neutrality, the two's going to change, but what happens is you eventually expand, and this brings you into, this is the goals of like in the fourth jhana, you just have equanimity. That field of experience becomes more and more and more neutral, and pleasant and unpleasant become lesser and lesser and lesser and less, and then one just abides more and more in equanimity with one's experience. Now, that's a lot of what I said there, it goes beyond just the cloth and just beyond our things. Obviously, the second of the four requisites, food, also quite fits into that, in particular around the idea of sensual indulgence. And some of the particular subtleties in the monastic form that I think I would recommend that lay people take on as well, if you really want to. This is the depth of the asavas. If you really want to not have a mind that's constantly moving and thinking, you have to really cut deep into some of the ways that we reinforce that habit pattern of the mind. And food is just like, it's all going to the same place. It's all getting churned up. It's all just nutriment. But what the most people do is they sit there with a hamburger in one hand, they sit with a French fries or potato chips, and they sit there with a soda, and they go fat, salt, sugar, fat, salt, sugar, fat, salt, sugar. And they just can't stand with one sensation. They have to move to the next type of sensation. Because really, if you actually meditate on and experience the taste and sensation of the food, it is so fleeting. It is so ephemeral. It is gone very, very quickly. And so, like, the simplest of trainings that we're instructed to take on is samaneras, the seiki trainings. I mean, there's a whole section on food, and there's plenty of other rules around the food and the vinaya as well. You know, that you eat in a methodical way. You have your bowl, and you put your stuff in it. Now, some monastics, and I do this occasionally, I go through periods of time where I do it, you just mix everything up. Or you mix up your cooked food, you mix up your cold food, whatever, or unprepared food. And you work in a methodical fashion. So you just work left to right, or right to whatever works for you. It's just, the thing is to be consistent. And so I just rotate my bowl. I guess this is counterclockwise, I just do it. And I just push the food, and I just work around a pattern. Every day the same way. Every day, you know, you get different foods, and sometimes it doesn't quite fit, and you got to adjust a little bit, but you don't get into the game of choosing. You don't get into the game of delighting in this and that and the other. And when you take that motivation and movement of the mind to have a choosing mind and just abide in whatever presents itself, it helps develop this neutrality towards the whole process. And this ends up having really dramatic effects on the mind in many, many different ways. But I mean, the monastic rules and the monastic, and this really points to the depths of the asanas. You know, as a monastic, we have 5 years of dependence on our preceptor, and that's usually after 2 years as a non-fully ordained monastic. So you have 7 years, and every summer we go over the Vinaya, and in any year we can't cover all the food rules. There's no way. And we talk about the rules for hours on end. Like, what is this? Should I, you know, are you given this? Do you receive this properly? So we have around, you know, food and how we receive it, who we receive it from, when we receive it, when we eat it, how we store it. Because really, food is like probably one of those primal things that there is in all of the animal kingdom. There's one rule that I think is incorrectly kind of translated and misinterpreted. There's a rule around not interrupting a couple of family when they're eating. And it's kind of translated and or commentarily is treated as a double entendre, which I'm not going to get into, I guess. I think it's kind of a mistake. But just look at, just consider the fact, like, if somebody, so we're not supposed to approach somebody if they're sharing food. Now look at the importance of, let's say, food and dating, or let's say a family sharing food with their children out at a picnic. If I was out on alms round somewhere and there was a family, then this is not the explicit, you know, according to the rule, I could go, or according to the modern interpretations rule, I could go, you know, present myself for alms round in front of this family, but I would find that to be really objectionable because it really puts people in a, it's a really affront to some very deep sharing that goes on inside the family unit. Obviously, as well, in terms of, like, if a couple is, like, out, especially, you know, it's a universal, culturally universal, like, the sharing of food and the development of a relationship. And there's just no place for a monastic to be involved in that. So that's why a lot of our rules around how we receive and share food with women are so paramount. because there's a lot of potential energies around it. I mean, I haven't done it as much as some of the monastics go to Thailand, but my year at the Pacific Hermitage and our weekly alms round at Bayagiri, you really get to see how that energy can really cause mental proliferation. Who you're receiving from, when you're receiving it, how you're receiving it, and it can disturb your mind for periods of time. So, these rules are laid down, and generally junior monastics should just really defer, because even after 7 years of being a monastic, it's really in the realm of your preceptor to say you're not really prepared to deal with some of these rules, and you have to stay in dependence. You have to request the leaving of dependence from the preceptor. And this is one of those classes of rules, the rules around food and allowables, that one should be particularly restrained around. And as lay people, business is done around food. Dating is done around food. And obviously there's a whole self-identification around dieting. Are you using your food for some self-identity in that way? As monastics, we take what we're given. Before being a monastic, I was a vegetarian. I became a monastic and no longer I feel it's inappropriate to be a vegetarian for multiple reasons, not just because people can offer it to you, because you only have one meal a day. Are you going to get the nutrition? So again, in this very simple paragraph, there's a lot of depth that we can use food and this basic guideline of restraint to see why am I outside this basic guideline? Because really, it's just for the maintenance of the body. It's just enough calories, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 calories, depending on there's some fairly standard, let's say, governmental norms that I think are probably way higher than you actually really need. But utilizing this as a way of then reflecting on what's the effects of the food, how do I feel? And the third one is lodging, which I've touched on a little bit. The bare minimum is like under the foot of a tree. Monastics generally are considered, Indians, the equatorial regions, it's probably more readily possible to live in the open. We often try to do it in the seasonal times as monastics in the West, but obviously there's really no way you're going to pull off sleeping at the foot of a tree in December or January here in Thunder Bay. We still should treat our dwellings as they're not ours, and that we should be able to relinquish them within the day. We shouldn't have so much stuff. Obviously the four requisites kind of preclude your ability to even have that much stuff, but they should be orderly and tidy enough that if you're asked to leave or need to leave, somebody says, "Oh, you need to go on this trip." As a monastic, that happens quite a bit. Senior monk says, "I need some attendant to go on some trip or some day trip or some weekend trip." Sometimes they'll specifically call out individuals and be like, "Okay, I'll take this monk, and that monk." And sometimes the lodgings monk might say, "Well, we have other monks coming in. I need you to move your stuff out." And that's not all that common. But even like in the West where a little outside the norm of let's say Thailand, where you don't really have any personal space really to speak of. We have sometimes have lockers. I've had it in Bayagiri, your locker changes all the time. You can easily stick up pictures of your favorite monks. Some people do that. Stuff like that, but you might be asked you got to change locker. Whenever we have ordinations, lockers change. Whenever you leave, you lose your locker. When you come back, you're never going to get the same locker. Probably two or three times a year, your locker changes, and you should just be expected to It's not yours. Keep it clean. Keep it neat. Keep it tidy. And in the monastic space, you have like, it's not yours. It's a public space. You know, here you have weather things, so we have, let's say, places for coats, places for boots. That's where they go. You know, that's why would one be outside that space? What's special about your stuff that you can't go in that space? Why do other people have to step over it? What sense of self is one wrapping around that if one's doing that kind of thing? Leaving books laying around, leaving a weight behind you of your things. The standard is cleanliness and orderliness too. So when it comes to accommodations in public space, that is like the de facto way it's done in the monastic form, because it minimizes one's conflict in the community. It's a standard that everybody can maintain and should maintain for the harmony of all other people. And you know, if one can't conform to that, it's a really solid basis for reflecting on what sense of self one might have around that idea. The last one of the four requisites is reflections on the medicinal requirements. Now, this was really rough. The bare minimum of the medical requirements for monastics is fermented urine. It shouldn't require any more than that. Or that's the minimal expectation one should have. Obviously, in the West, we've gone far beyond that. It should be provided by society. But, I mean, you know, it's quite simple. That, like, am I really utilizing? And this is one of our foremost monastics in the West, I've heard, and this is kind of hearsay, has said that we really have a problem with allowables in the West. I remember one time I was at this monastery, and a layperson presented this tray of shredded ginger, hard cheese, it had pepper in it, and oil. It was like a little, like, looked like a coleslaw salad of allowables. And you're like, really? Is this for is this for medicinal requirements, or is this just an afternoon indulgence? So, you know, reflecting, what is really the disease of the body? You know, and a lot of these different practices we do, that, you know, I've seen monastics who take on this, like, I'm going to do this forever kind of mentality. I generally find that any kind of adhita or any kind of determination is often best done in, like, for Vasa, for a year or for a month, because you'll see benefit from it, and then maybe you won't see benefit, and then maybe you kind of relax your standards a little bit around allowables, and then increase your strictness around allowables. Like, if you take allowables, see how the mind, like, moves towards them, or what's the need for them. Or medicines, you know, like, Ajahn Chah is a particular note, like, because people are like, you know, you have, like, say, cough drops, they have sugar in them. Should it be treated as medicine, or they should be treated as allowable? He's like, well, are you taking them as medicine, or are you taking them for the sugar in them? And so you're looking at, so really the point of all the practice is going back to this nature of intention and looking at asavas in that way. It's like, am I doing this for sensual indulgence? Am I doing this for a sense of self? Am I doing this to perpetuate some sense of permanence or belief of delusion around suffering or not suffering? And so there are these lines that we draw in our practice, and as lay people, you know, you take it on 5 precepts or 8 precepts at different times in your life, and there are these lines that we can go up against and say, okay, why may I want to step over that line? And it puts us in a place where we're going to have to look at our intention to step over that line. So these four requisites are, they seem real simple, and I'm really only touching on, like, you know, especially around food, especially around, you know, this food can is really one of the most primal things, and we can often create unbelievable, like, virtuous reasons why we might be doing what we're doing, eating what we're eating, or we can create, we can just indulge in this sensual game of ever seeking fresh delight now here, now there. And you'll never really progress instilling the mind unless you take this somewhat seriously. And however seriously you take it, that's the benefit you'll get. That's the way the Dhamma works in all levels. If you want your mind to still a little bit more, well, consider the fact that these kind of choices have an impact on it. It's not just sitting on the cushion and expecting to get results in 30 minutes a day sitting on the cushion. I mean, look at what we do with our phones. You know, people, I mean, I don't, but people do in the world. They're like, they can't stand a moment of neutrality. They can't stand just being present. They have to get another fix. They have to click the remote, that channel. Oh, there's an ad, there's another. What's next? What's next? What's next? What's next? And then why is your mind constantly moving? Why do you keep thinking? Why can't you calm and still the mind? It's because you haven't seen the real value. And in order to see the real value in it, you actually have to invest some time in it. You invest some time in it, you'll see the value in it. And really that is that it is more pleasant. It is more pleasurable in terms of that pleasure that is beyond the senses to have a mind that doesn't move to the world. The world comes by, it flashes, it flickers, and it just sits still. And it goes, huh, that's the best you can do, Mara? Not good enough today. Okay, so again, that's the four requisites. And it's in the bigger picture of the Sabhasava Sutta, which I consider one of the preeminent practical suttas on the training. It's the second sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya for a reason, in my opinion. The first one being the Mula Pariyaya, which is a very heady, but basically says any place where you imagine there's any form of objectification, you're wrong. So you have a very high level sutta on the theoreticals, and then here's a very practical sutta, number two, and it's one that can be read and contemplated. Pretty much you could do it, use it, I think, every day and be the only basis. It's one of those suttas that can be the entire basis for your practice. But you might get neutral to it and seek a different sutta because you need something else. Anyway, that's all I have for this evening.
Andamayam dhammakataya sadhu karam dharamase sadhu 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 animodami.